I hope you're doing well. Welcome this morning. It's good to be here. You have heard already that we're going to be talking about faith and doubt. And I had no doubt this morning that my oatmeal was going to stay the same, taste the same, because I control the sugar, which is the best part. I also knew I had no doubt that I was going to make it to church, depending on my driving skills and all that. I can't control everything, but I knew that I was going to be here this morning, so that's always good. Sometimes a pastor's fear is that something's going to detain you, or that you're going to get there and you've forgotten your notes, which is, yeah, not good. So I don't doubt that I won't be a millionaire. I don't doubt that I'll live to 120. I do doubt that I will like broccoli, ever. I also doubt that I'll be really good at golf at any point in my life, because you actually have to do it more than once a year. Doubt is a factor in our lives. It's always a piece of our journeys. I have had doubts about ministry, about health, about relationships, about safety, about decisions, you name it. It could be an area in your life and mine that doubt can slip in there. I want to read a couple of illustrations that characterize doubt in different ways. The first is related to a little girl having gone to Sunday school, and when she got to her mother after church, her mother asked her what she had learned in Sunday school, and this is what she said. She said, "I learned how Moses built this pontoon bridge across the Red Sea, and how all these people were transported across with tanks and personnel carriers, and as soon as they were across, the bridge was blown up just as the Egyptians were coming across, and they were all drowned in the Red Sea." Dead serious when she said it. And the mother was astonished. She asked if that's what the teacher actually told her. She said, "Well, of course not," the little girl replied, "but you would never believe what she really said." Someone has said that that little girl is like a lot of people. They think that faith is believing in what isn't true. And for others, that faith is little more than wishful thinking. Another story of a young man who had been raised as an atheist, who was training to be an Olympic diver. And the only religious influence he had in his life was from an outspoken Christian friend of his that never stopped nagging him about the faith. So this young diver never really paid attention much to his friend's sermon as often as he heard them. But one night, he goes to the indoor pool to practice. And the lights are off, but the school had these incredibly large skylights, the moon is out, and he had enough light to see what he needed to see to go diving. So he climbs up the high board, he finds the highest one that he can, climbs to the top, gets to the top, and realizes, "I'm good to go." So he stops for a second, and he puts his arms out to get ready to get in pose for the dive, and he sees his reflection, because those lights behind him, enough a light to see, on the wall he can see a cross. He sees this cross formed because of his body, and he literally on that high dive board kneels down and invites God into his life. Just as he does, as he's standing back up and ready to dive, a maintenance man walks into the building, turns on the lights, and he realizes the pool had been drained for repairs. Some of the adventures in faith that we will experience are the kind that leave us bewildered, the kind that may induce fear or leave us questioning the possibility of success or the believability of a healthy, positive outcome. Yet what may seem impossible to us or what causes us deep concern or leaves us doubtful often opens a door of possibility from God's standpoint, from His point of view. And that open door can inspire faith in us in spite of our perplexing circumstances. The things that would leave us dumbfounded and cause us to our faith to be shaken, like the language that we would use, "My faith is shaken." And it causes us instead to draw closer to God and to be inspired in our faith. In other words, faith can win over doubt. And I say faith can win because it is a choice to choose to continue to believe what is true about God and what He says, and to choose instead to be doubtful and let that infect our faith. Gordon MacDonald expressed it this way. He said, faith is an ability to trust in and draw upon the power of God beyond my rationality, my instinctive pessimism, and my willingness to settle for less than best. That is what King Jehoshaphat's struggle was. In our story this morning from 2 Chronicles 20, if you want to kind of track along, four neighboring nations came to make war against King Jehoshaphat and his people, the people of Judah. And we read in verse 3 of 2 Chronicles 20, Jehoshaphat was afraid. I would think, no kidding, four nations greater than you, with more power than you, coming at you, they're afraid. Of course they're afraid. We read that Jehoshaphat is afraid. Doubt and fear, I would say, are very close relatives. Very close relatives. If you're doubting about something, analyze it. I'll bet you there's something about it. There's an element of fear in it. And fear can certainly make you doubt all kinds of things in your life. The question for us is, what do we do when we doubt things will turn out for the better? When we are skeptical of a positive outcome, or when we're just plain afraid of what could happen next? That catches a lot of us. So even though he was afraid, what Jehoshaphat did next is instructive to us in responding to circumstances that for us may naturally lead to fear or skepticism or doubt in our own lives. So I want to suggest a few things this morning from Jehoshaphat's experience that I think can both diminish our doubt and fear and also strengthen our faith. So the first thing is that we learn the value of shifting focus. The value of shifting focus. Verses 3 and 4 say, Jehoshaphat was afraid and turned his attention to seek the Lord. Judah gathered to seek help from the Lord and to seek the Lord. He turned his attention to seek the Lord. Literally means to set himself a certain way, to give himself to. It literally means to turn your face. So when you're talking with someone, if you have ever had someone say to you, look me in the eyes, our first experience in life is that comes from our parents. Look at me when I'm talking to you. And if we don't catch it there, we catch it from our teacher. Look at me when I'm talking to you, instead of the floor or your shoes or whatever. He turned his attention toward God. He did everything he can physically, mentally, and every other way to fix himself on God, not the problem. He was afraid, turned his attention to seek the Lord. When we're afraid, we often give greater attention to the source of our fear, the source of our doubt, than we do to the possibility that God might have something to do with getting out of that situation. I talked about this a little bit last week. It is so easy for anything painful or difficult or challenging or something that has shaken what we believe to get out of that. We just love laboring on it. We love bringing it up. We love talking to friends about it. I've said in different contexts, when we're like that, we often like to find five other friends that think the same way as we do. And then we all gripe together or have a pity party together or complain together. We'll sign lists and petitions because we all feel the same thing instead of doing something about it, which means choosing instead of doubting and letting it grow and build in you that leaves you so cynical. I wonder what God would do about this. I wonder what God thinks. The shift is in focus is off of what causes doubt and fear and onto the Lord Jesus. One author says, faith hears the inaudible, sees the invisible, believes the incredible, and receives the impossible. The author of Hebrews said in Hebrews 11:6, it is impossible to please God without faith. Substitute it with doubt, substitute it with fear, whatever. You can't even please God with your life because you're so focused on that negative stuff. Anyone who wants to come to him must believe that God exists and that he rewards those who sincerely seek him. Jehoshaphat turned his attention to seek the Lord. To seek literally means to pursue. It has the idea in the word of to tread or frequent. It's like when it's said of Jesus, Jesus often went to the mountain to pray. It's like he did it as was his custom, a couple of the Gospels say. It's like there was a path. that the disciples knew to take to get to that place where they used to pray, because they frequented that place. They sought that place. That's the use of the word here. Second thing that we can learn from Jehoshaphat is the urgency of prayer. Some would say it's urgent any time to pray. It's important any time to pray. But there are other times in life when it's just plain urgent that we pray. For Jehoshaphat, with armies all around him and terrified of what could be next, he immediately seeks the Lord and he prays. Verses 5 to 6 and then verse 9, he says, O Lord, God of our fathers, he's suggesting that we have an ongoing story with you, God, and we need you in the midst of our story today. O God of our fathers, are you not God in the heavens? Rhetorical questions. Are you not ruler over all the kingdoms of the nations? Power and might are in your hands so that no one can stand against you, regardless of what comes our way. Same as Jehoshaphat. We will stand before this house and before you, for your name is in this house, and cry to you in our distress, and you will hear and deliver us. Nobody that doubts to the extreme that it's all over would ever say, we know that you will hear us and deliver us. His faith was never shaken to the extent that he would abandon the hope that God had for him. Jesus several times said, come to me. Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, who are doubtful, skeptical, cynical. Come to me. Jesus said, ask and seek and knock. And when you do, what you ask for, what you seek for, what you knock for will be given to you. Paul said, don't be anxious, but do what? Pray. Don't be anxious. Pray. And when you begin to doubt and fear, pray. A third thing that we can learn is the necessity of owning our limitations. This is the non-popular one. Learning to own our limitations. Culture says, do everything that you can to make your limitations and inadequacies of your skill set and all those things, make them better. Up the grade. Reality is we spend so much time trying to make ourselves experts in areas of our life that we're just not gifted and wired to do, that we waste opportunity and potential to keep flourishing in the areas we are. But we need to own our limitations. In this case, there are two limitations. First of all, we are powerless. Powerless. Verse 12, the beginning of verse 12, we read, we are powerless before this great multitude. Easy parallel. Easy to understand. An army's coming at you that's greater than you are and your own potential individually and as an army to fight back. You are powerless. Means you do not have enough power to do what you need to do, what is coming against you. In life, a lot of us feel powerless at times. I have had times when our children were ill or something was wrong in the family and there was absolutely nothing that you could do. So you go back to the second learning and pray really hard. But you're powerless. You can't fix certain things in life. You can try all that you want and it doesn't happen because you are limited in the power that you have. We're also, it gets worse before it gets better, we're also helpless. The second part of verse 12 says, nor do we know what to do. Not only do we have armies coming against us that are stronger than us and will overpower us because we're powerless, we have no clue how to respond to the threat. None whatsoever. But then there's that word in the Bible that I love in many instances. It's the word but. And I have it circled in my Bible. But. We're powerless, we don't know what to do, but our eyes are on you. That's his prayer. Our eyes are on you. Who do you look? I'm curious. I mean, don't answer the question because it's rhetorical. When you go through a difficulty in life and doubt creeps in or your faith is shaken somehow, who do you go to first? A best friend? Spouse? Somebody that may be an expert in the field of where you're wrestling. How many of you, actually, the first thought that comes to your mind is, oh, God, I need help. That's the point that he's getting at. The necessity of owning our limitations. Jehoshaphat is praying to the Lord that God, you would help us because we're powerless, because we're helpless, and we know that you aren't. You are the opposite of what we need today. Our eyes are on you. Hebrews 12:2, the author again of Hebrews says, let us fix our eyes on Jesus. The kind of blinders that you have that it is all you can see, it's the focus of your attention, the complete and sole focus is spending time with Christ. I was talking with one of our younger pastors last night, and he was making some significant decisions about his future, and I asked him, why did you decide what you decided? Because he, to me, decided good. He made a good decision. And mostly, especially when it's the guys, I will ask them, did you listen to your wife? because we men learned the hard way that they're filled with insight and all kinds of things that we lack sometimes. And the first words out of his mouth, well, I took a week off, and I went away, and I just prayed, and I spent time with God trying to figure it out. And then I asked him about, what did your wife say? Because I knew what she said, because we'd heard her say this. Juan and I had a conversation. She said this. So, yes, I also talked to her, but I took a week off. And I discerned this was what the mind of the Lord was in this matter. Before that, doubt, uncertainty, fear, anxiety, all those wonderful things that he took to God, like, just like Jehoshaphat suggests. But there's a final one. We need to learn the need for encouragement. God answered Jehoshaphat's prayer, and he does it through a man named Jahaziel. I don't know if he was a prophet or not, but he was God's spokesman for Jehoshaphat. So Jehoshaphat received encouragement from the Lord related to four realities. Four realities. It's like a pep talk before the battle. So here's the four realities that he dealt with, and these are the four realities that I think if you take anything home today, if you want to chew on something and wrestle with something, see how these fit into your journey if you're wrestling with something related to faith and doubt. First, fear and discouragement are unnecessary. They are a choice, absolutely, but they're unnecessary. Verse 15, thus says the Lord to you, that is to you, Jehoshaphat, do not fear or be dismayed because of this great multitude. Remember, he already knows he doesn't have the power, doesn't have the ability, he can't do it. So he's being reminded by God, don't be afraid. Don't be dismayed because of this great multitude. 1 John chapter 4, verse 18, the old apostle John writes, there is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. One author said, a perfect faith would lift us absolutely above fear. And that kind of faith only comes when we're fixing our eyes on Jesus, only comes when we're focusing our attention on the Lord and coming to him in prayer. Only coming to him and recognizing who he is. And in that context, fear and discouragement are absolutely unnecessary. Look to Jesus. The second reality is that it's not ultimately your battle. I meet people all the time, and I'm not perfectly immune to this, meet people all the time who make other people's problems theirs. Like they've got to fix that. Somebody else shares something with them, and they get all anxious and upset with them, and they want to do something about it. And they go home, and they affect their spouse now because of it. And the reality is it's not that person's battle. 2 Chronicles 15, this prophet is saying from God to Jehoshaphat, the battle is not yours, but it's God's. So who do we focus on? You focus on the Godward piece, not the enemy piece, because you cannot do the other one. You're powerless, you're helpless. It's not your battle. Some of the things that you deal with in life, only God can help you through, and you have to decide that these are my limitations and I own them, and only God can help, so who do I go to? I absolutely can talk to my spouse, and I can get insight from my friends that I trust, people who believe in me and all that. I do not go to people who just want to tell me what I would like to hear. I go to God, and I accept the fact that it's not my battle, but it's God's, and ultimately only God can make a change and make a difference. But there's one more. Trust leads to stability. The last piece of advice God gives through the prophet in verse 20, put your trust in the Lord your God, and you will be established. Put the trust in the Lord your God, and you will be established. I love what Isaiah 7:9 says. It says, unless your faith is firm, it cannot make you stand firm. Unless your faith is firm, you cannot stand firm. It's one or the other. A number of months ago, I used an illustration of Blondin and the many times that he crossed the Niagara Gorge on the tightrope. And a piece of that story, which never has been verified as true, was the fact that he did at one point take a wheelbarrow across and came back with it. But what isn't validated is whether or not he actually asked somebody, will you ride in it with me? And that they did or didn't. But supposing that this Blondin guy comes up to me and asks you, do you believe that I can push this wheelbarrow across? And you said yes, that means you had faith in Blondin that he can do that. And if he looks at you after saying yes, now would you be willing to be the one that gets, I would paraphrase it, would you be the crazy one who really doesn't love life to sit in this and let me take you across? That requires trust in Blondin. And I think there's a distinction sometimes between faith and trust in this picture. Because in the first case, you have faith that Blondin's going to succeed. But in the second, accepting the invitation to cross with him would demonstrate remarkable trust in that person. And there's a difference in our life sometimes between faith and trust. But the result of trust is stability in our faith and the overcoming of our doubts. Here's a summary of how Jehoshaphat's story ended. Jehoshaphat literally sends a choir ahead of the army to sing and to play their instruments. And they're praising God for his enduring love. And God destroys the enemy army even before Jehoshaphat and his army get there. By the time they arrive, everybody is dead. They didn't do anything, but it ends, we read in verse 29 of 2 Chronicles 20, that the fear of God was on all of the kingdoms of those countries when they heard that the Lord had fought against the armies of Israel, because God is on their side, and God is on your side. When you doubt, when you're afraid, when you're cynical, all of those things, God is on your side. So faith had won over doubt, and I think the same can be true in your life and in mine, and it all has to do with where you place Jesus. In a moment, we're going to transition to communion. But to do that, I just want to spend a moment reminding us of someone else who wavered between faith and doubt, and sadly, he's remembered more for his doubt than his faith. And of course, I'm talking about Thomas, and he will be immortalized in our minds as Doubting Thomas, unfortunately. I want to read a couple of brief passages. The first is from Luke chapter 24. While they were still talking about this is after the resurrection, while they were still talking about this, Jesus himself stood among them and said to them, peace be with you. They're in the upper room. They're literally in hiding in the upper room until something else happens. Jesus shows up, says peace, and of course they're startled and frightened. Right after he says, have peace. He says this, why are you troubled? Why do doubts rise in your minds? Look at my hands and my feet, it is I myself, touch me and see. A ghost does not have flesh and bones as you see I have. When he had said this, he showed them his hands and his feet, and while they still did not believe it, because of the joy and amazement, he asked them, do you have anything here to eat? They gave him a piece of broiled fish, and he took it and ate it in their presence, which was meant to substantiate the fact that he was actually alive, actually in the building. John chapter 20. On the evening of the first day of the week, when the disciples were together, with the doors locked for fear of the Jewish leaders, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." After he said this, he showed them his hands and his side, and the disciples were overjoyed when they saw the Lord. Now Thomas, also known as Didymus, one of the 12, was not with the disciples when Jesus came. So the other disciple told him, "We have seen the Lord." But he said to them, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were and put my hand into his side, I will not believe." He chose at least to be skeptical. A week later, his disciples were in the house again, and Thomas was with them. Though the doors were locked, Jesus came and stood among them and said, "Peace be with you." Do you think they'd get the peace thing yet? Peace be with you. Jesus' presence means peace. Then he said to Thomas, the rest of the disciples are around them. He points Thomas out, doesn't say, "Thomas, can you come over? I want to have a moment with you in a corner quietly," right in front of the rest of them. "Thomas, put your finger here, see my hands, reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." Thomas said to him, "My Lord and my God." A nice spiritual reaction. Jesus said, "Because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who have not seen me and have yet believed."